Happy holidays from the DSR Network. We are deeply appreciative of our members and the year that we've had. To celebrate the holiday season, we are offering a 50% discount on either your first month or first year of membership. Members enjoy an ad-free listening experience, bonus content for virtually all of our shows, an invitation to the members-only Slack community, and more. Best of all, if you become a member in the month of December, you can take 50% off the membership price for the first month or for the first year. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code DSRHOLIDAY at checkout. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code DSRHOLIDAY. Thank you very much for your support.
Happy holidays from all of us at the DSR Network. As we all spend the holidays with our families, we're bringing you some of the best episodes from the network on some of the biggest events of the year. We hope you enjoy this look back at 2023, and please, look forward to another year of Deep State Radio.
Nine, 12, 10, 28, 2, 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of our podcast. Today we are here to talk about the events that began to take place over the weekend in Israel and in the Palestinian territories. And we are joined by two of the smartest and best people we know to talk about those issues. Rula Jabrial is a scholar and an author. Welcome today, Rula.
Thank you, David. Thank you.
And Alon Pincus, he is an author for Haaretz and former Israeli diplomat. How are you doing today, Alon?
Good, David. I mean, you know, all things considered, sorry for the cliche, but fine.
Well, let's talk about all things considered. Rula, I understand you left Israel just the day this took place. And let's start with just a framing comment. How do you view the events of the weekend?
David, it's hard to comment the event of the weekend without not looking back and seeing how this was predictable and preventable. And I feel sad to say this, but you and I and Ilan, we've been meeting every time these kind of events occur, and the same policy have been put in place, the same exact policy. I will keep repeating the same exact policy, creating the same cycle of horror and barbarism and violence. And it is heartbreaking to talk about the insanity of a situation that cannot be solved militarily. We know this. Elon knows this. The Israeli military established know this. The government knows this. Yet, deliberately created a situation where, knowing what Hamas is, what their goals are, yet the priority was to take more settlements in the West Bank, to create more annexation, to defend this this group of, I'm sorry to call them fanatics, that trumped everybody, everything else, security, politics, rationale, reasoning, humanism. And we are caught now again in another cycle after 57 years of military occupation, 17 years of brutal siege on Gaza, 2 million people behind, basically, you know, in cage. And we're looking at a situation thinking that that could not have produced Hamas. Of course that produced Hamas and would produce even worse than Hamas. Even if Hamas is erased tomorrow, just to be clear, this will not change the equation that we need to find a political solution to the Palestinian issue, because there's no other solution. And I am horrified. This morning, I woke up and I find all these messages from my colleagues and my friends who are burying their loved ones. While they're burying their loved ones, they point out to statements where Israeli official would say, including minister would say, Hamas is an asset. The Palestinian Authority is actual liability. We need to dismantle these moderates that actually recognize Israel, dealt with a lot of the security issues, but also are willing to concede on so many things and willing, again, to find a political outcome that guarantee dignity, freedom to the Palestinian and security to Israel, but they rather somehow exploit Hamas because it's easier to keep this state of warfare.
Alon Brula is making reference to a quote that I've seen that Prime Minister Netanyahu apparently stated what she just said outright. Maybe you want to pick up on that and then offer your views on the weekend.
Well, there's not a line or an argument in what Brula said that I disagree with. I agree 100%. Obviously, you know, we're not here to start comparing narratives because one of the tragedies of the Israeli-Palestinian issue is that they've developed a zero-sum narrative. If I admit that you are right, and if you admit that I am right, it's as if it negates everything I stand for. It's as if it negates your entire foundational beams on which you built a nation or a movement. And so I'm not here to compare narratives, and I do subscribe to everything Brula said, really. Now, as for the last quote that you asked me to allude to about Netanyahu, yeah, that has been his policy for a long time. That is why, by the way, that is why he is pursuing the, well, it now looks like a distant history, a distant memory, certainly irrelevant now, today at least. That is why he was pursuing the Saudi deal, because here's the thing about him. He has three working assumptions: that a Palestinian state should never be formed side by side Israel, let's call it from the Jordan River in the east to the Mediterranean Sea in the west, that the Palestinian issue is an invented issue. I'm talking about Netanyahu, yes, not about me, not about Rule, not about you. This is Netanyahu's credo, that the Palestinian nation is an invented nation and therefore has no right of self-determination. And therefore, And therefore, it is not, as many think, it is not the center of the broader Arab-Israeli conflict. And I, Netanyahu, the grand statesman, I will prove that I can achieve peace without paying in Palestinian currency. And then, because of other reasons as well, his own political problems, his own personal legal problems, he's on trial, an ongoing trial on three counts of corruption and bribery and obstruction of justice and whatnot. That's why he formed this lunatic government. Some people in his government are 100% fascists, and they seek annexation, and they seek to create an irreversible de facto, even short of formal annexation, in which a two-state solution, not now, I don't think it's feasible now, but to make it impossible, to make it unviable, to make it territorially disintegrous to the point that people are going to raise their hands and say, all right, screw it, this is never going to happen. Now, the tragedy that he never understood is that this leads to a reality of a one-state solution that a big majority of Israelis do not want, that a majority of Palestinians do not want, but a majority of Palestinians will say, well, you know what, you want us, you have us. Now we ask for one man, one vote. And this is where he's leading Israel. Now, this has nothing to do, supposedly, with the massacre, the horrible massacre that Hamas committed. But Rula is right. It didn't come out of nothing. It didn't come out of nowhere. And whatever massive retaliation Israel intends to inflict on the Gaza Strip, that is not going to change the equation. Back to Rula's last point. This is just another point on this endless, vicious, cyclical trajectory of conflict. And I, you know, sorry, I have nothing more optimistic to say. Certainly not today, but it is what it is.
Can I add something, David, to Alon? You know, Alon statement about the Saudi deal. The whole idea that Netanyahu conveyed for the last 15 years, he's been in office on and off for more or less 20 years, and he's always told Israelis that he will keep them safe, that he is the only one that can keep them safe, that because of his tough rhetoric, because of the use of the military here and there. And then we forget that, you know, he's actually the one that made the calculation to exchange Gilad Shalit, one soldier, for 1,200 prisoners with Hamas, creating an incentive of Hamas brain that hostages, actually Israel will negotiate somehow. But not only that, he decided at a certain point, we can actually ignore the Palestinian issue. They don't matter. They don't matter. We can go to all these Arab countries, cut deals with countries that Israel never had wars with, and then Israel, the most important, powerful military force in the region, can make deals with the most important economic force in the regions, the UAE and Saudi Arabia and other, and this will undercut completely and cancel Palestinians. In the meanwhile, his ministers were calling to erase Palestinians every day. Not only that, they're calling formally, like Smotrich, the finance minister, and Ben-Gvir, to basically wipe out Palestinian villages. While the world go, you know, do their things and pay attention and take their kids to school, whatever, and Israelis, you know, go to parties, rightly so, and enjoy their freedoms. On the other side of the fence, on the other side in the occupied territories, they've been taking place the most horrific act of violence in these last 2 years. Nobody mentions, but 300 Palestinians died this year, last year as well. Since 2008, 8,000 Palestinians died. So this kind of drip, 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 drip violence on daily basis, and not only the killing, the harassment, the ethnic subjugation, the humiliation, the destruction of property, destruction of life, destruction of hope. And then you weaken the only authority that is there. And then you're conveying this message. The Palestinians, somehow this conflict can be managed. We can manage it with more walls, with more tanks, with more weapons, and create a delusion that somehow nobody will react. They will die in silence. Sadly, tragically, they gave Hamas the biggest propaganda weapon they could use to radicalize people. And for me, it's horrific what Hamas did. I can never live in any state where people like Hamas govern or reason. But in the same time, we need to understand after 9/11, we evaluated how did that happen, why did that happen, and how to can prevent such attacks in the future. Today, the only narrative in Israel, let's bomb Gaza, let's erase them. I mean, I think the head of the army was saying, no food, no water. I mean, the response to barbarism is not more war crimes. I understand that. I mean, I love Robin, clearly. I have this myth about all his mistakes, but there was a logic in what he was doing. Negotiate with, you know, fight terrorism and negotiate for a political solution. The other option is not present in this moment, and it's not even on the horizon. And this is what's creating a cycle of violence that we are all looking at in desperation.
You know, Alon, so far I've agreed with everything that both of you have said, with one exception, with Rula just...
I don't know why they pay you the big bucks for this, for hosting.
Yeah.
bring people, you tell them you agree with them, we go.
Yeah, well, as it happens so far, it's true, but with one exception. And that is that Ruhl was talking about essentially that there is one narrative now. But what has struck me is that within Israel, almost immediately after the horrific attacks, there has not just been one narrative. There has been a real sense that there was a huge intelligence failure on the part of the Netanyahu government, that the Netanyahu government helped create the conditions for this, that you had this extraordinary thing that we've never seen in one of these, where you had ex-Israeli generals getting on television and saying, this is on Netanyahu. And I just thought it'd be interesting to hear your comment on that.
Well, it's 100% on Netanyahu, and I wrote that 2 days ago, and I wrote it even more forcefully today. It's not published yet, that he should be removed from office immediately, not after the war, not in the context of some coalition game, but right now, because this is 100% on him. Now, here's the thing with the narrative. On the face of it, David, Ula, Israel is faced with a binary choice, a very difficult choice, but nonetheless a binary choice. There's no in between. Either bomb the hell out of Gaza and carry the consequences that Rula described, and even worse, or do the exact opposite, negotiate with Hamas. Now, I'm not advocating for this. I'm just saying there is no other way, because otherwise you're going to perpetuate this cycle, and it's going to get exponentially worse. Now, as for the narrative, until Saturday, for 9 months, almost 10 months, exactly 10 months, actually, the narrative was that Netanyahu has launched a constitutional coup, that he is incapable, inept, incompetent, and should not be in office because he has declared war against his own country, and stage an anti-democratic coup d'etat via constitutional means. Okay, the pushback was impressive. You had hundreds of thousands of people come out. Now came this game-changing, probably, arguably, the worst day in Israel's history, Saturday, October 7th. The narrative can't go back to what it was, because now people are making the inextricable link between what Netanyahu has done in the last 10 months and how this came about. The arrogant dismissal of anything having to do with the Palestinians. The statements that he is not only not going to negotiate with the Palestinians, but he's going to okay de facto annexation. The actions enlarging settlements legitimizing or legalizing, rather, so-called illegal outposts. And then, if you recall, and I'm sure both of you recall, on March 26th, he fired, although that lasted for 28 hours, he fired, so to speak, the defense minister, Yoav Gallant. Why did he fire him? Because Gallant indicated that he intends to speak to the nation while Netanyahu was in London doing laundry or whatever. And he was going to speak and alert the public to the toll that the constitutional coup is exacting on the military, and that Israel's national security is being hampered, that the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces, levels of readiness and preparedness are being compromised. And Netanyahu hurriedly fired him. Then, a few short weeks thereafter, he refused to see the chief of the general staff. So, you know, the writing was on the wall. Now, today, there's a story circulating, to the veracity of which I don't know, that the Egyptian minister of intelligence apparently warned Netanyahu in a phone conversation that Hamas is planning something big. But while I don't know if that's true or not, but while just one last thing about Netanyahu, the narrative is that not only is this on his watch and he is you know, patently ill-equipped and incapable of managing this, but that he brought this on Israel. Now, obviously, the tactical intelligence mistakes perhaps were the IDFs, the operational mistakes were the IDFs, but the overriding responsibility is Netanyahu's. And one last remark, you know, when Hamas was apparently planning for this, he flew all the way to San Jose, California to chat with his buddy Elon Musk on artificial intelligence. I mean, how absurd and tragic and sad and ludicrous does this look now? And so that's the narrative. That's the narrative. This is not just me talking. That's the alternative narrative that is being uttered these days in Israel.
Yeah. Now, so Rula, let's turn to what's likely to lie ahead. You made reference a moment ago to a statement that was first came from senior government officials, subsequently come from several spokespeople in the military, that the next step for Israel would be to turn off the water and food and electricity to Gaza. There are 2 million people in Gaza. Half of them are children. It's the most densely populated place on earth. Simply attacking Gaza puts many at risk. But clearly, laying siege to Gaza is likely to produce great suffering. I happen to watch one of the statements by an Israeli military spokesperson, and he tried to, in very calm terms, say, well, you know, we're at war. What do you expect us to do? Shortly after that, there was a statement attributed to Hamas, and again, it's hard in these times to know what's true or what's not, but essentially said, if you do that, we will start killing the hostages that we have, one at a time. Obviously, this is precisely the cycle of mindless, destructive escalation that you were referring to at the outset. Where do you think it's going to go?
Carnage, bloodshed, mass slaughter. You know, not only, and I understand and I feel the pain of my Israeli friends, and I see the barbarism and this attack, and I understand the desire for security and peace. I mean, every human being deserves that. But I also, I'm aware of the mass public opinion. I think we are, three of us here, are minority in trying to convey a rational thinking in a moment of total irrationality and in a moment where the far right is seizing the narrative that we are at war with this genocidal group. They want only to kill Jews, and et cetera, et cetera. You know, we heard this narrative that been put forth by the far right for decades. It's not today. This is a far right that depicted Yitzhak Rabin as a traitor, as a Nazi, simply for wanting to negotiate with the Palestinians. And in the end, you know, the guy that killed him is more famous today in Israel than ever, Yigal Amir. But where do I see this? I see this descending truly in savagery. I was watching yesterday BBC and CNN, and Naftali Bennett, former prime minister, was speaking, and he said something about bombing schools, bombing homes, bombing hospitals, that there's no place that is safe for Palestinians in Gaza. Well, if you decide to do that, and I'm thinking ahead, and because I understand not only what you feel, and I empathize with the suffering. As you know, David, I have family, you know, in Palestine and Israel. But as a human being, I understand the suffering and I see these horrific images. And as a human being, as a mother, as a woman, it's jarring. In the same time, I know what will happen when you start bombing these schools and hospitals, etc. The entirety of the region and the world will start watching this savagery. And that's a moment where they will start again and again questioning what we're questioning today. Then you erased Gaza, and what's tomorrow? What's next? You break it, you own it. Under Netanyahu's watch, hundreds of people were murdered. Under Netanyahu's watch, we had the highest rate of hate crime against Christians and Jews and Muslims. Under Netanyahu's watch and his far-right government, we destroyed any hope for Palestinians ever to live in dignity. And now we need to look at the rubble and try to find the silver lining, a resolution to all of this, because otherwise this will be not only 5 years. We're looking at our lifetime where we'll be caught between a dictator and a group of terrorists. And I refuse to be inside of this equation. I don't want to be ruled by a dictator in Israel while I'm looking at the other side. And the only people left there, because we destroyed the moderates, are the terrorists. That's a cycle that needs to be broken. And Israel cannot do it alone. And this is where the international community comes in. When everybody tell Israel, we support you unconditionally. And for years, they've been telling them, we support you unconditionally. They're forcing them to live in the delusion that the world will support them regardless whatever they do, including war crimes, including genocidal rhetoric, including genocidal attempt, ethnic cleansing. And this world that you're looking at supporting them in this moment, there's another world that's called the Global South that does not support them, that look at this and see the moral relativism, where the world is asking why we're supporting Ukrainians to fight Russia's occupation, and at the same time, we're enabling the occupation of millions of people for the last six decades. I think these are tough questions that need to be asked. These are tough truths that need to be told to our Israeli friends. And that cannot come only from people like us. It had to come from the administration. The fact that Trump's pet project, which is the Abrahamic Accord, became the Biden foreign policy for the Middle East, this cannot be the only foreign policy in the Middle East. President Biden has been a great, remarkable leader, but he can lead a diplomatic effort with the help of the region to help also Israelis, especially the martyrs that have been on the street that don't want Netanyahu to thwart totally Israeli democracy. And by the way, what Netanyahu is doing, the coup that Ilan was talking about, this is, doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from the mindset that was developed in the occupied territories that we don't need really democracy. Somehow, something else is better than democracy. It's ethnocracy, it's theocracy, it's something else. This comes from the lack of accountability of whatever happened in the West Bank. He is basically importing from the West Bank the autocratic model and want to impose it on Israel. Different terms, but more or less the ideology is there.
So, you know, normally, by the way, this is the point in the podcast where I'll take a break and I'll tell people who aren't members that they should go sign up to be members to listen to the rest of the podcast. But I think this is too important a discussion. And I want to make this podcast available to everybody from beginning to end to listen to it. And Alon, Rula brings up a point here, which honestly I've been uncomfortable with for the past couple of days. And I'd be very, very interested in your reaction, because the response
you've been uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable. In other words, in the United States, the response has reflexively been blank check for Israel. It has been whatever Israel wants, we support. Because, of course, you have this horrific attack, the equivalent, if Israel were the size of the U.S., of 33,000 people being killed. And so the response is, we stand beside you, we will do whatever you say. But literally, within hours of the United States saying that, you've had people in the Israeli government come out and say, the people of Gaza are animals, you know, and say that they should have the water and their food cut off. And I guess my question to you is, what is the appropriate response from the international community, from the United States? Is it a blank check for Netanyahu and his administration?
No, I don't think it's. Let me put it this way. It's premature to make an intelligent assessment on what should or be prescriptive in, on what should the international community, but forget the international community, the U.S., is going to, how the U.S. is going to treat this, only because we don't know the extent, the level, and the intensity of Israel's response. There could be a devastating aerial and missile attack on Gaza. I'm not for and I'm not against. I'm just stating the options. But there could also be a ground operation. A ground operation could be limited and carry limited successes only, or it could be expansive and basically recapture, reconquer, reoccupy the Gaza Strip. And like Rula said, in a slightly different context, you break it, you own it. At which point Israel is responsible for anything from car theft to garbage collection to schools to hospitals to everything in the Gaza Strip. I don't know that Mr. Netanyahu wants that. In fact, I have no idea what the hell he does want. And by the way, Rula, even though I don't disagree with 99% of what you said, there is one silver lining. Netanyahu is not going to survive this.
I agree with you.
I'm not saying that whomever replaces him is going to radically change policy, ergo the previous government did nothing. However, it really David, all depend back to your question. It really all depends on what Israel does. Now, a ground operation on the one hand, or a massive aerial campaign, that is because of the density of Gaza, the 2.2 million inhabitants, the lack of infrastructure is such that a blockade, negating them of food, water, electricity, and oil is gonna put Israel in a very, very precarious and almost untenable situation vis-a-vis the international community. There used to be a formula that the U.S. in the first 3 hours, the U.S. stands firmly behind Israel. Then the next 24 hours, the U.S. calls for restraint and understands Israel's right to defend itself, et cetera, et cetera. And then Israel essentially has 96 hours to go berserk, whether it's the West Bank, whether it's Gaza, whether it's Lebanon, in response to terror attacks, to one terror attack, or indeed to an entire intifada. And I think what you will see is the U.S. closely watching this for the next 4 or 5 days to see how deep and how expansive Israel's reaction or retaliation is going to be, and to look for signs of possible escalation in Lebanon. Yes, there's the West Bank, East Jerusalem, where it could escalate. But in terms of firepower, in terms of a regional war igniting, Lebanon or Hezbollah in Lebanon is the problem. Now, you, David, write a lot about American foreign policy, and I think you will agree with me that this is nothing more. This is not a crisis management that anyone in the Biden administration wants to deal with. This is a nuisance. This is an irritant. This is something that's off the agenda, that superimposed itself on the agenda. There's Ukraine and Russia. There's China is the big challenge. There is strengthening NATO. There is a mess in the House of Representatives that affects aid to Ukraine. There are alliances being built in the Indo-Pacific. The last thing the U.S. wants to do right now is be dragged back into this quagmire called the unending, evergreen, or ever destructive Israeli-Palestinian issue. So my simple answer to you is I think it's going to be observe, watch, and be alert for the American administration. If this escalates in Gaza and potentially in Lebanon or the West Bank, I think the U.S. is going to force Israel, is going to try at least to pray, not force, that's a wrong word, pressure Israel to stop. Because, by the way, a successful or an unsuccessful Israeli operation that ends with Israel occupying 75% of or 100% of the Gaza Strip is a headache for the U.S. It is not something that they say, all right, it's been resolved. No. The trouble only begins. And the U.S., which has been disengaging from the Middle East, is going to be dragged back. And I don't think Biden wants this. I don't think Anthony Blinken wants this. I don't think anyone wants this.
Rula, you and Ilan have said that you don't think Netanyahu is going to survive this. That would, we can only hope. It also seems unlikely that the current leadership of Hamas will survive this. And the question becomes, is there any prospect on the horizon of any effective alternative leadership emerging within the Palestinians?
Absolutely yes, David. Absolutely yes. You have 5 million Palestinians. The fact that we're even wondering that, it tells you a lot of things. The fact that many in the West wondering, is there, it's the same, propaganda that's been put forth that we have no partners on the other side. Well, when you decimated everybody and when every, whether a journalist or an intellectual or others is either in jail or behind, in cages, of course, you're not looking at them as like where we can find moderate leadership, but the leadership is there. It's always been there. It just simply you need to understand, that by bolstering or supporting indirectly backing Hamas because you want to prevent the creation of a viable Palestinian state. That is your strategy instead of the real option, which is looking at the Palestinian society and trying to look at the peaceful advocates, people who call on daily basis, on monthly basis for reforms within the Palestinian Authority, but also abhor Hamas methods. The fact that Hamas is so unpopular, it tells you everything else about also their tactic. They're trying to also to stay politically relevant. They're so irrelevant because after witnessing how they govern, most Palestinians basically reject them. And very often they are jailed by Hamas because they reject their ideology, they reject their methods, they reject their strategy. However, in a situation where you're offering Palestinians either an apartheid or a cage de facto, that drives actually radicalization. That actually what really empowers Hamas in the end. And even if you erase Hamas tomorrow, there's the Islamic Jihad and other terror group. However, David, and I remember because I was born in that region. I was born, to a family from Jerusalem and from Haifa. Palestinians were the most secular people in the Middle East, the most highly educated. How did we get to a point where we have groups like Hamas? It wasn't born out of a religious ideology because we don't have one. I grew up in Jerusalem next to the Aqsa Mosque. My father worked in the Aqsa Mosque for 30 years. Our community was Christian and Muslim. And the people who are closest to the holy sites in East Jerusalem were actually the most secular one. But across the Middle East, if you look at other countries surrounding us, we were the most secular people in the Middle East. Hamas, and I look at not only Hamas and any other group that use that kind of violence and barbarism, because the occupation in itself breeds that kind of violence and barbarism. And that's where I go to the political solution. When Rabin decided to do the Oslo Agreement and decided to negotiate, not because he loved Arafat and loved the Palestinians, Ariel Sharon decided to withdraw from Gaza, not because he really wanted to release Gaza, but there's a moment where you have rational thinkers thinking at what can I do realistically to prevent what happened Saturday? That's what they're thinking. Netanyahu for the last 10 months have been thinking, how can I stay in power and stay out of jail? So these two things cannot be compatible. I hope Netanyahu's political life is over for the sake of Israelis and Palestinians alike. But what I would love also to see an approach from the American administration, especially this administration that really started its tenure saying international order, we need to fight any occupation and invasions and we need to stand by democracy. Does that democracy applies also to the Palestinians? Do we deserve freedom and human rights and dignity? And this is the main question that needs to be put forth to this administration about, do Palestinians deserve that kind of dignity and freedom and democracy? Or we don't deserve that because somehow we're, sons and daughters of a lesser God. And a final note, and I say this with a lot of pain, the response that a lot of Palestinians have been warning that this is coming and been warning for decades, not today. After every cycle of violence, I started working in the United States 10 years ago. And I remember the first time I went on television, it was when, Gaza was being bombed. And during that period, 2,200 people died, of which 500 children. And we always told everybody, without a political solution, there's, you can go nowhere. But also I saw how the West reacted to, Ukrainians' heroic fight for their statehood, for democracy, and for their freedom. And the point, and I understand that the West didn't want, to send billions of aid and whatever, but in the end they did it because it was the right thing to do. Today, as Palestinians, we're asked to guarantee the security and safety of our occupier. Can you really ask Ukrainians to guarantee the security of Russians? You can't and you should not. At the same time, you cannot ask Palestinians to guarantee the security of their occupier, especially when Netanyahu just now is decided to release hundreds, thousands of weapons to settlers in the West Bank that have been terrorizing Palestinians, burning villages in Hawara, in Jenin, and elsewhere, brutalizing Palestinians, glorifying genocide and violence.
They did not murder 800 children, and, you know, at point blank.
And I'm not saying that they did burn people, but to continue with the same policy that drove radicalization, I think is madness at this point. I'm not trying to equate, and I'm trying to justify, Ilan, believe me, I'm far from even defending this barbarism. What I'm trying to say that arming settlers in this moment will drive hate crimes in the West Bank where Hamas doesn't exist even.
David, I have an idea for you. A practical idea.
I'll be short. I would welcome a practical idea.
President Biden joins, listen carefully, you might like this, Xi Jinping, okay, and Mohammed bin Salman, not our favorite person, the three of us, but nonetheless, the three of them, whether it's in Washington or whether it's in Geneva, because Xi Jinping wants to be treated as a superpower and not come to Washington, the three of them summon Mr. Netanyahu or whomever is the prime minister in the next 2-3 months, and Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, the president of the Palestinian Authority, and knock their heads and say, "This enough is enough is enough. Either something comes out of this room in the next week, take your time, take 3 months to come back with, take a week to talk about what you can agree on, take another 3 months to iron out what you cannot agree on, take another month to put aside what you absolutely cannot agree on, and then we build from there. Otherwise, none of us is going to support none of you ever again."
So, how about that? Well, first of all,
it's a dream.
I guess I like the more elevated aspects of the dream. I don't think that I would elevate MBS for any reason under any circumstances.
Nor would I, but he's capable of pressing, if he so desires, he's capable of pressing the Palestinians,
well,
which Biden, Xi Jinping may not be able to.
No, but that's true, although Xi Jinping does have the ability to pressure the Saudis and the Iranians both. Having said that, you know, listening to what Rula just said, Ilan, one thing strikes me, and that is radicals need other radicals. The radicals in the Israeli government seek radicals like Hamas because they justify their radical policies. And the only way to achieve a political solution is if you do not have both sides dominated by their most extreme elements. And as it stands right now, the best way to achieve that is to move, you know, the Israeli government towards a more moderate, less extreme point of view, and thus open the door for something similar to happen in Palestinian territory.
You invariably mean a different government. You cannot move this particular
government. No, well, that's right. Is that remotely possible, is my question.
No, it is not. That requires an entirely different government, absent the presence of the lunatics, the extremists, the zealots, the theocrats, and the fascists. By the way, they're not a majority in Israel, nor is Hamas a majority amongst the Palestinians. That's part of the tragedy of
yes.
all this. You know, the blood is boiling now, but if you take a huge poll of Israelis and Palestinians, you will see a lot of suspicion, a lot of distrust, but a clear majority in both to get this over with somehow. Somehow. The thing is, both sides are being held hostage here. Israel, with its endless cycles of elections, Netanyahu forming this kakistocracy, you know, the government of the most unable and ill-equipped and inept, filled with religious fanatics, Hamas, which is ruling Gaza like you know, in ways that maybe North Korea is governed. And there you have it. It explodes in everyone's faces, and 1,000 innocents get killed, and 1,000 Palestinians are going
to
get killed.
Hundreds of thousands this time, just to be clear.
No, not hundreds of thousands. You know what? I don't want even to get into that. It's one man is the tragedy. Hundreds. You're right. I don't know how many. I don't want to go into a numbers game, but you're probably right.
No, if I may, it's just I feel like if the what we are hearing from the intention of the kind of operation they want to lead, and if really the statesmen translate to actions, I fear because of the way Gaza is, and because of the 2 million people, and because of the way it's looking, but also because of the anger, which I understand, it will lead. I think they feel also humiliated. They feel like for exposed for the first time, like, you know, this is a security state. This is a country that sells surveillance and weapons and teach other countries, like, we will tell you how we can dominate a situation. They feel humiliated militarily. And I think there will be an overreaction. And I fear that because I saw even the United States overreact after 9/11. I've seen them. I mean, when I hear politicians saying we will reshape the Middle East, I worry because I heard the last time I heard that kind of rhetoric was George W. Bush. And then he basically, you know, invaded every kind of, you know, country to start to avenge what happened to 9/11. And in the end, we ended destabilizing the Middle East. And out of that, ISIS was birthed and other organizations that were even more horrific than Al-Qaeda. So again, I hope they don't overreact. And I hope, because if they do, with the situation of Gaza as it is now, I don't think, you know, a scenario of 2,000 people like the last war will be even a number we will be discussing. I think the atrocities and the casualty will be much higher this time.
I couldn't agree with you more. The United States went into Iraq and 600,000 innocent Iraqis died as a consequence of that. And I think that was in some way the objective of Osama bin Laden. Exactly. Because Osama bin Laden and Hamas and Netanyahu all have in common this desire. They can be empowered if they radicalize the other side. And, and we have to break that cycle of pain. And the big takeaway I get from this is that means that the United States and the international community cannot give Israel a blank check in their response to this. That does not in any way justify the horrors inflicted by Hamas. No. Indeed, the reason that they can't is because we want to stop this. And the only way to stop it is to break the cycle. I don't know that we're any closer to that. By the way, I think that's a third rail in American politics as well. But I think it needs to be discussed. I hope we can continue to have this kind of constructive conversation. I have only the deepest respect and fondness for both of you, Alon and Rula. And I'm so glad you could take the time to join us for this conversation.
We're so privileged to make you so happy tonight with all this, you know, optimism oozing out of both of us.
You know, David, I want to thank you and Ilan. It's just very hard in these days and these moments as a journalist, as an activist, also as an analyst. I continue to think that, you know, Israel cannot exist, you know, by the might of force and live by the sword, because it's proven more and more again, you know, that it's not going to stabilize or guarantee any security for anyone. And I think people like us have incumbent on us to make our politician, wherever we are, understand that we cannot continue to, the world views them as an occupier, and even the unconditional support will continue to make them bury their head in the sand and again and again. This is not attainable, not because of what happened, or not despite because of what happened, but because of what happened. You know, it's glaring to everybody that without a political solution, we will be back to discuss the same thing, maybe in 6 months or 1 year. And I hope we can discuss something else.
I do as well. I do as well. Thank you, Alon. Thank you, Rula. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll be following this very closely, and hopefully we'll be continuing this conversation sometime soon. Until then, bye-bye.